Part of the reason why I pursue neuroscience is because I have a special place for the brain. I put it on a pedestal because I think of it as a seat for the mind. It's the part of the body that lets us feel emotions and process abstract thoughts. But at the same time, whenever I read papers that sort of look into body-brain connections and the circuits that are involved, I'm always surprised at how much the brain does. Apparently, it's not just a thinking machine. It also controls a lot of bodily functions. And today I have a paper on that topic. I have a paper here that describes a body-brain circuit that regulates body inflammatory responses. And that's actually the title of today's paper, A Body-Brain Circuit That Regulates Body Inflammatory Responses. The paper was published on May 1st of 2024. And the first author on the paper is Hao Jin. And the paper comes from Charles Zucker's lab at Columbia University. It was 5 or 6 months ago that I first read this paper, and I was very impressed by the work that they did and the amount of scientific knowledge that they add to our understanding of the brain. The topic is also very different from what I study in lab for my project. So part of the fascination for this work comes from that rationale. Okay. We've talked about inflammation in this journal club before, and we talked about it in the context of neuroinflammation, specifically for Alzheimer's disease. So there is a neuroinflammation component to Alzheimer's that we observe in patients with that neurodegenerative disease. But I've never considered the brain to be a place or a knob to modulate how much or how strong of an immune response or how much of an inflammatory response that the body mounts towards an infection. And that's what they show us here in this paper. So it's actually a very clever approach. I don't know if this is very common in the study of immunology or not, because I happen not to be in that field, but they injected mice with lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, LPS for short. LPS is a component, it's a sugar component of the cell wall of gram-negative bacteria. So this is found in the outer coat of membrane on certain kinds of bacteria, not all. And whenever our immune system or immune cells come into contact with this compound, LPS, the immune cells mount an inflammatory response. So it detects that there has been an infection with that bacteria, and it tries to counteract it by starting all these processes in the body to clear that infection and hopefully keep us safe and healthy. And whenever mice are injected with this LPS, they mount their own immune system, and we see an actually quite rapid increase in the mounting of that inflammatory response. So the LPS is injected intraperitoneally to the mice, so this would be in the abdominal cavity of the mice, and 2 hours after that, we see an increase in interleukin-6, interleukin-1 beta and tumor necrosis factor TNF. Really important terms in the world of immunology. Not so much important for today's discussion. I'll describe what each of these does and what they are used for in this particular context. But these are markers that the body is going through inflammation and it has activated its immune system. So they would inject these mice with LPS and look at the areas in the brain that have been activated due to this exposure to LPS. And they looked at an expression of an immediate early gene called CFOS and tried to see which regions in the brain have been activated acutely right after the injection of LPS. And what they observe here is that there's a specific area in the brain called the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, or the CNST for short, that is, and this brain region is activated acutely after exposure to LPS. Before reading this paper, I was not familiar with this brain region, but I'll give you some introduction to the CNST. The CNST is located in the brain stem, so this would be in the hindbrain, the back part of the brain. And the brainstem, we think of it as an essential part of the brain. It's one of the oldest parts during development, and it does control a lot of vital activities in the body, including our heart rate, our blood pressure, our breathing rate, sleep, digestion, arousal, movement. It controls a lot of things, so there's a reason why it is vital. And depending on which population of neurons in the brainstem, it processes sensory information before relaying it to the higher brain regions. And let's say a person was to have an injury in their brainstem. It's going to be life-threatening with very limited recovery. And if that person recovers from that insult to their brainstem, the effects will be long-lasting and profound. So it's not a brain region to mess with. And so whenever the mice were injected with this LPS molecule, we see an activation of this brain region called the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract that is found in the brainstem. All right, that's one piece of information that's relevant to today's story. Along with this, and from prior research, we know that the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, the CNST, is the primary target of the vagus nerve and functions as the major conduit in the body-brain axis. The vagus nerve is this really interesting nerve that comes out of the brain and innervates the thorax and the abdomen. It's quite popular nowadays because of its role in the gut-brain axis and the body-brain circuit. And it's highly mentioned in popular science media. The vagus nerve is a cranial nerve that includes both motor and sensory nerve fibers. So the brain controls our internal states, including our heart rate, breathing, and digestion, using the motor fibers. So we're not conscious of it, but the brain sends nerve signals to the heart, the lungs, and the gut, the intestines, so that they function properly. And at the same time, it collects information about the internal state of these organs using the sensory fibers. So the vagus nerve is a bidirectional nerve. So I don't want you to mistake this. Their neurons function in a unidirectional manner, but the vagus nerve is a bundle of multiple neurons. So what we have is there's neurons that send information upwards from the gut towards the brain, and then there's neurons that send information from the brain down to the gut. And if you think of the axons as wires, those wires are bundled together, and we consider that as the vagus nerve. And more important for today's journal club, one of the areas of the brain that are innervated by the vagus nerve is the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, or the CNST. And I think that sets up a good introduction to today's story. There's a part of the brainstem that gets very active acutely after infection, and that brain region gets sensory input from the vagus nerve. All right, now I'm going to tell you about the methods and the techniques that were used in this study, and the data that resulted from those methods. I've mentioned this one before. One of the techniques that we use in modern neuroscience is we inject modified viruses directly into a certain brain region so that we can localize where we want the virus to be expressed. And then we can, for example, add in a fluorescence reporter that increases in its brightness intensity whenever there is nerve activity in a brain region. And that's exactly the technique that they use to verify that this brain region, or the CNS, this brain region, the CNST, is activated whenever mice were mounting an immune response towards LPS. If you inject mice with this GCAMP, this modified green fluorescence protein that senses for calcium, and if you inject that GCAMP virus into the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, and then at the same time inject the mice with LPS in their abdominal cavity, we will be able to record an increase in activity in those neurons of the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract. Before I go on, I'm going to take a moment here and let listeners know how difficult it is to inject into the brainstem. I have done this in lab. It's fairly difficult, but it's even more difficult when it comes to injecting into the brainstem. One reason is the brainstem, well, the hind brain has a lot of blood supply, and making that injection into the brainstem is difficult because if you puncture any blood vessels, then the mouse might bleed to death during surgery. So that's one problem. And just a moment ago, I told you that the brainstem is a very vital region in the brain. So you don't want to make any mistakes, especially with coordinates, when you're making these injections. And you want to be very careful. So this approach of injecting a virus into the brainstem is a very difficult technique. And the authors and the research team in this paper deserve a lot of credit for what they did. And so they've injected the GCAM virus into the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, and at the same time injected LPS, that saccharide of gram-negative bacteria membrane, into the periphery, into the abdominal cavity. And what we see here is that there's an increase in calcium activity in the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract. And more importantly, if you do surgery on these mice and sever the vagus nerve, so if you cut the vagus nerve in the chest area and the thorax area so that the abdominal cavity and the brain are not well connected, what you see is that increase in activity in the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract disappears. That increase in fluorescence that we observed from the GCAM virus is no longer as intense as what we would have if the vagus nerve was intact. So this tells us that the immune response that is mounted in the periphery is being detected by the vagus nerve, and that signal is transmitted all the way to the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract via the vagus nerve. And if you have the paper on you while listening to this journal club, you can find out all this information in Figure 1. Specifically, if you look at Figure 1C, you see that there's some sort of recording coming out of the mouse's brain. So they're shining LEDs into that brain region, the CNST, and recording from that brain region with a filter for just the green color, because the GCAMP protein fluoresces green, so we want to be selective about the wavelength of light that we're recording. And what you can see is at the same time there's an injection of either saline or for control or LPS into the peritoneum, which would be the abdomen of the mouse, and you can see that there's almost a 50% increase in fluorescence intensity whenever LPS is injected into the mice. And if you cut the vagus nerve or sever the vagus nerve, and I'm guessing in the thorax, that abolished the transfer of the immune signals all the way to the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract. And so that's the model that we're working with. So I'll just try and reiterate what I just said. If there's an infection, if there's some sort of inflammation in the periphery of the body, and by periphery, I should describe what periphery means. It just means outside of the brain. Then that inflammatory response that the body mounts towards that pathogen, towards that infection, is sensed by the vagus nerve and transmitted all the way to the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract in the brainstem. That's what we're working with. Another major technique that was used in the paper is chemogenetics. I have to admit they used chemogenetics extensively. And okay, how do I approach this? How do I describe chemogenetics? Chemogenetics is this way of increasing or decreasing the activity of neurons using designer drugs that work on designer receptors. So I'm using the expression designer here in both the receptors and the drugs, because the receptors were genetically designed so that they can allow the flux of either positive or negative ions, depending on what we want to enter or exit the neuron. When activated by designer drugs, which are these drugs that do not have any effect in the body unless they encounter that specific designer receptor. So both the receptor and the agonists, the drugs, are designed to work together when they're both present. If one of them are present, then we don't see that increase or decrease in nerve activity that we expected. Now, there are some caveats here, because one of the most widely used designer drugs, the clozapine N-oxide, CNO, could be metabolized in the body and changed into a psychoactive drug called clozapine. But let's ignore that for today, partly because these experiments were done acutely. They would inject the mice with either CNO or LPS and then look at the immune response that they're mounting 2 hours after that exposure. So we do not have to worry about a lot of side effects from the use of chemogenetics or clozapine N-oxide in this particular context. I had to mention that caveat, but other than that, chemogenetics is an excellent technique that we use in neuroscience. And in this study, the research team used two kinds of DREDS. DREDS is the acronym for designer receptor exclusively activated by designer drug. You don't have to remember this. DREAD is just the acronym for these designer receptor, designer drug combinations. And in the paper, they used a DQ and a DI DREAD. The DQ ones are used to increase the activity of neurons because they lead to the influx of positive ions into the neurons. So they depolarize the neurons and drive more and more activity. And the opposite of that would be the influx of negative ions through the designer receptor DIOHM4DI or the DI DREAD, and that would lead to the decrease in the activity of neurons because the membrane potential would be hyperpolarized and there would be less activity in those particular neurons. And again, these designer receptors could be packaged in modified viruses and injected into a specific brain region so that the neurons in that brain region express the designer receptors and their activity could be manipulated by the exposure to those designer drugs. That was the major technique that they used in this study. So now let's move on to some of the results that they see. And so the first thing that they did was they used this technique that I do not fully understand. It's targeted recombination in active populations or TRAP system, and that they used that to target Cre recombinase, the activated neurons, whenever they were injected with LPS. And so what they do is they can specifically target those neurons that are activated from the mounting of an inflammatory response and have them express this protein called Cre, which regulates the expression of those DREAD channels that I told you about, those chemogenetic receptors. And when they inhibited the activity of these neurons, what they saw was an increase in inflammation. So the levels of interleukin-6 and interleukin-1 beta, IL-6 and IL-1 beta, in these mice dramatically increased. And if you have the paper, you can look at this in figure 2, panel B, in the bottom panels. You can see that they're whenever they're LPS-treated mice and the mice have had the DI DREAD in those neurons, we see a very high increase in IL-6 and IL-1 beta interleukins in these cytokines. But along with this, what we observe is that there is a decrease in the expression of anti-inflammatory cytokines, the IL-10. Interleukin 10. So in this paper, they used IL-6 and IL-1 beta as reporters of pro-inflammatory state. So these are cytokines that promote inflammation and the activation of the immune system. And IL-10 is the interleukin that they use to measure anti-inflammatory state in the body. So these would be against the activation of the immune system and the immune cells. And what we observe is that the expression of whenever there's LPS treated mice and the mice have had the DI DREAD in those neurons, we see a very high increase in the pro-inflammatory cytokines and a decrease in the expression of the anti-inflammatory cytokine IL-10. And the values here are given in picograms per mils. And I'm guessing this is blood samples taken from the periphery of the mice. So this would be blood sample outside of the brain collected from the body. And after that, they used the same approach, but this time, instead of using an inhibitory DREAD like the DI DREAD, they used an activation DREAD, which would be the DQ DREAD. And what they see is that when these neurons in the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract are increased in activity, we observe a decrease in pro-inflammatory markers such as IL-6 and IL-1 beta, but an associated increase in the anti-inflammatory marker IL-10. And so what we gain from these experiments and from this figure is that depending on the activation or inhibition of these neurons in the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, the brain can sort of modulate how much inflammation or anti-inflammation is present in the periphery of the body. With that said, so the next question that the study addresses is how does the vagal nerve transduce the signal from the periphery to the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract? The inflammation leads to the release of cytokines, and those cytokines are what work on the endings of the vagus nerve in the abdomen, and that those nerve endings of the vagus nerve carry the information all the way to the brain. So that would be the hypothesis that we're working with. And so the research team would use a very direct approach. So they infused cytokines into the gut, which would be the intestines, very highly innervated by the vagus nerve, and record neural activity in the cell body of the vagus nerve. For you to imagine this, think of the vagus nerve as a bunch of neurons in a place called the nodose ganglia. You don't have to remember this. It's just a region located right below the skull. And that would be where the cell bodies of those neurons will be located. And then these cell bodies would send out their axons into the thorax and the abdomen to collect sensory information. And if you have the paper on you, look at figure 4A. We have the mouse brain, where the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract is depicted in red. And right underneath it, in green, we have the nodose ganglion, which are the cell bodies of the vagus nerve. And the nodose ganglion extends towards the peripheries, making connections with visceral organs like the heart and the gut. It's a pretty neat diagram here. So what we do in this study is introduce cytokines to the vagal nerve endings in the gut and record the activity of those neurons in the nodose ganglia using calcium imaging. And what we see is that the neurons that respond to anti-inflammatory cytokines are different from the neurons that respond to pro-inflammatory cytokines. So if you look at figure 4C, we see the calcium fluorescence of multiple neurons. And there's a gradient in that heat map from blue to red, where red indicates high neuron activity, and blue showing lower activity, and the activity of the neurons is dependent on which cytokines are introduced to the endings of the vagus nerve. Some neurons increase their activity to pro-inflammatory cytokines, while others respond to anti-inflammatory cytokines. And interestingly, there is no overlap between the two populations of neurons. The next validation in this study is using chemogenetics directly in the nodose ganglia. Earlier, the chemogenetics was used in the brain and the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, but now we are activating the vagus nerve bundle to see the effect in the immune system, and that's what they see in figure 5. And depending on which neurons they activate in the nodose ganglia, we see either an increase or decrease in pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines. Remember, these vagal neurons respond to either pro- or anti-inflammatory cytokines in the first place. So if we selectively increase or decrease a specific population of vagal neurons, then that will reinforce the state of inflammation or anti-inflammation. For example, in panel B of figure 5, they increase the activity of vagal neurons that respond to anti-inflammatory cytokines. And by the way, these neurons are distinct in that they express a protein called TRPA1. We don't have to get into it, but that protein signature allows us to be selective in which neurons we activate in the nodose ganglion. We see a decrease in pro-inflammatory cytokines and an increase in anti-inflammatory cytokines, which is measured by IL-10 levels, whenever those TRPA1 expressing neurons are being activated using chemogenetics. And the opposite is true, which we see in panel E. When the pro-inflammatory responding neurons are increased in activity, they will reinforce the pro-inflammatory state. Okay, so far we have a chain of information processing and relay here. Infection happens. Cytokines are secreted by immune cells in the periphery. Those cytokines are detected by the vagus nerve, where some nerves relay anti-inflammatory information and others relay pro-inflammatory information to neurons in the brainstem. And this is a positive feedback loop. If anti-inflammatory cytokines are detected, then the brain will reinforce that state. And if pro-inflammatory signals are detected, the CNSD neurons that respond to pro-inflammation will reinforce that pro-inflammatory state and lead to the secretion of more inflammatory cytokines. The last part of this study looks into the protective properties of activating the anti-inflammatory neurons in the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract. I'll describe one of these experiments. There's, I think, a few of two or three experiments in that same figure, but I'll focus on one experiment and show you how the research team used their system here to look into a disease. And it really caught my attention when I was reading this paper. In figure 6 of panel, in panel C of figure 6, they introduced this concept to a model of ulcerative colitis, which is a disease of gut inflammation. If mouse models of ulcerative colitis are given dextran sodium sulfate, they will have symptoms of that disease. They'll be inflamed, and there will also be an increase in fecal blood. But if we chemogenetically activate the anti-inflammatory neurons in the vagal nerve bundle or further up in the brain and the caudal nucleus of the solitary tract, we see a decrease in inflammation and also fecal blood score. And they report this data in panels E and F. The DSS is the dextran sodium sulfate, and the HM3DQ is the chemogenetics activation of the neurons. I think this is amazing. In this single paper, they characterize a neural circuit with inputs and outputs and also point out potential uses in therapeutics. It's still very early to use chemogenetics in humans, but this is a proof of concept for me. And this approach to tamp down inflammation systemically gives it a really wide use. It could be used to treat many inflammation-related issues in the periphery just by modulating the activity of neurons in the brain. But I do wonder if the brain has a similar setup for inflammation within the brain. I'm not sure if the vagus nerve sends projections into other regions of the brain, but a sensory system that can detect neural inflammation could allow the brain to regulate its own inflammation. And that would be a big breakthrough in the world of Alzheimer's disease research. Yeah, fingers crossed. I hope you learned something from today's journal club. It's a step away from the dopamine system that we talked about in the previous few journal clubs. I hope you were entertained by the techniques that we use in the lab. And as always, you can find the paper and the authors in the episode notes. Kudos to Haojin and colleagues, and Charles Zucker at Columbia University. Until next time, ciao.